welcome to the F1 Strategy Report for Formula Legend. On this week's edition, the German Grand Prix, why is Nico Rosberg so bad? And why is Ferrari so bad? That's all to come on this edition of the Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato. I'm on a train. This is very theatre of the mind stuff because it's the mid-season break, so we're physically as well as metaphorically moving away from the final race of the first half of the year. And I'm on this train with my guest. He's a freelance F1 journalist. His name's Abhishek Takle. How are you?
I'm good, Michael. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fine. It's good to be in the break, isn't it?
Hasn't felt like much of a break yet, but it's been hectic this day.
Over time, I'm sure it'll feel better. It'll feel a little bit calmer. But it has been a very busy end to the season because we've had 6 races in 8 weekends, which is a lot. And this is, of course, Formula One's longest ever calendar. And it sort of culminated in that sense, didn't it? Because it really felt like in Germany that everyone wanted to go home.
Yeah, I think everyone was just sort of keen to get on with it, get done, and go find a beach to lie on somewhere. And fair enough, because they've all earned it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair to say. Yeah. It has been a hard-earned after the longest first half of the year, I think, in Formula One history. But specifically to the German Grand Prix, we were treated after 1.5 average-ish races to a pretty interesting one, actually. The tyres came alive, there was fuel management and expectations, the temperatures were high, there wasn't any rain, and we actually got to see some pace play out amongst the cars. Now let's start from the very beginning. Well, let's actually start a step before the beginning and talk about qualifying, because Nico Rosberg got pole for his home Grand Prix, which not everyone expected, given he had a problem on his first run and Lewis Hamilton's obviously in fine form. But all of that was irrelevant at the end of the day, because he lost it once again on the first turn. Now, before we get into the strategy, this is key because Hamilton took it off him from the first turn, which is usually the opposite of what happens.
Absolutely. I mean, the start is where Nico lost it, because he'd been, you know, this was the weekend, home weekend. I mean, if you think too much about the home
nominal
advantage,
home
but
Grand Prix.
Yeah, and this was the race he wanted to sort of seize the title lead back from Hamilton, which he had conceded the last race in Hungary, right?
Mm-hmm.
He dominated the weekend, really, if you think about it, topping all practice sessions. Hamilton probably saving his engine, was running a bit down on par on Friday. But on Saturday, Rosberg just pulled out all the stops. I mean, that was a phenomenal pole lap, if you think about it. He was carrying 3 laps of fuel. He had just that one shot. Stayed cool under pressure and delivered. But then the race happened.
And then didn't deliver in the end. Ultimately, Rosberg's story is one of non-delivery. It's interesting to note that Lewis Hamilton, not often a man we regard as someone who actively, I guess, is introspective in terms of his form, because he's the guy who can jump in the car and be really quick. You know, he doesn't do a lot of in-season testing, doesn't do a lot of simulator work, but it was interesting to learn that after the start of the year, when his starts were very poor, he has a man who's helping him with his starts, a start coach, and that's been really key to him being able to overcome Rosberg's advantage.
I think that's very interesting that he has a start coach. I mean, look, Michael, a lot of sports, a lot of players rely on coaches, but Formula One is a sport where drivers don't really go to coaches. I don't know why that is, but they just don't like to be told how to drive. So it's really interesting. Hamilton's basically got himself a start coach. He's identified his starts as a weakness, as they have been the first sort of early part of the year. And it's worked for him, because Hungary, he made a great start, got the lead, and was never challenged. Same in Germany. So it's obviously working for him, whatever he's doing with the coach.
Now, if we look at the overall strategy expectations of this race, Pirelli was pretty firm that 3 stops would be the fastest way, although somewhat marginal with a 2 stop if you could get the tyres to last. But it was pretty warm in Germany, and also because this track does require a little bit of fuel, the cars were all quite heavy, so it was leaning towards the 3 stop race. I want to say first and foremost, though, because we will be looking back at the first half of this year a little bit later on in general terms, we've had this 3 tyre rule introduced in 2016. The medium tyre, the hardest tyre, almost didn't feature at all this weekend.
It didn't. I mean, I think that was just, they just sort of, some teams didn't even bother running it in practice, I think. They just sort of gave it back to Pirelli as they're supposed to. But some teams used it as a practice tyre, sort of did a few laps on it, and that was it. It was never really a big part of the weekend at all.
I wonder if there's a refund involved for those teams who can just give them back. I don't want them. They're no good. They're not as fast as you promised.
They can give me one and I can use that for a coffee table probably.
Yeah, we'll take them. If you don't want them, I'm more than happy to take a free medium tyre. There was a great difference in strategy, actually, which is fantastic given that there were so many limitations in this race, whether it be heat or fuel, because normally in those situations we see most drivers just do essentially the same thing. Not only do we see differences in each individual driver, but even the teams, by teams I mean Mercedes and Red Bull Racing, they split their strategies amongst themselves. There are two things I want to pull out here. First of all, Hamilton did the optimum strategy, did his optimum race because he was in the lead. Red Bull Racing has sufficiently regained confidence, I think, to the point where they were looking at two stopping, even though they wanted a strategy focused on the super soft tyre. Now, that's an interesting return to winning psychology for Red Bull.
Absolutely. Red Bull have just been resurgent this year, and I guess coming out of the slump that they went into in 2014 and especially 15, and now sort of being able to string a strong run of results, that confidence is coming back. And you know where I think that confidence really stood out was they went in planning a two-stopper, realized, look, this is not working, degradation's too high, let's switch to a three-stopper. And they did that in a very agile, nimble way, where they sort of adapted perfectly to a three-stopper. And that agility they showed on the pit wall, I think, is a greater sign of confidence that they're showing again than anything else, really.
And this was a pivotal moment. The first stops were a really pivotal moment in this Grand Prix because the heat combined with fuel made the super soft tyre, on which obviously the top 10 started on, given that's how qualifying works, made it not very usable in the opening stage of the race when fuel was heavy. Degradation was really quite high, but Hamilton and Ricciardo were placed on the soft tyre, which theoretically should have been better, and in truth was better, whereas Verstappen and Rosberg gambled on another stint on new super soft tyres, I beg your pardon. And that kind of undid their races in respect, because after that we did see that Ricciardo had an optimum strategy because Red Bull asked Verstappen to let him pass. Brave move on Red Bull's part as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the logic behind putting Rosberg on that strategy on the super soft rather than the soft for following the first stops would have been because, remember, he lost out not just to Hamilton but also the Red Bulls at the start. So they probably thought, let's put him on the super softs. You know, he can sprint, do a few sprint sort of quali-style laps, get past the Red Bulls, and then sort of just look after his tyres until the next stop. But that didn't work out because he couldn't find a way past the Red Bulls, and it only compounded his degradation problem, really.
He did find a way past one Red Bull, technically.
Well,
move, I want to talk about that move for a moment, because I think this interesting implications for Rosberg for the rest of the season. We will be talking about Rosberg, don't you worry, in a moment, properly. But it was a similar move to the one he pulled off in Austria, because his strategy did demand it. He shouldn't have been behind Verstappen at that point. He needed to be ahead of him. What was your take on that Rosberg move, and what do you think his thought process is now when he's going wheel to wheel?
Look, I think the move in Austria looked a lot more deliberate. I'm not saying he did it purposely. That's not at all what I'm saying. Only he knows what he did. But it looked a lot more deliberate, and there was a lot more context to that move. You know, dueling Hamilton, not wanting to lose to him in a wheel-to-wheel fight after having done so for so many races. So there was a lot of underlying sort of context to that move in Austria. Here, I think he found himself quicker than Verstappen. Went for a move down the inside. Verstappen, I don't think, quite saw him, and he moved away. And then Rosberg realized Verstappen hasn't seen him, so suddenly he just slowed down. He just really slowed down to crawl on the inside and just looked very clumsy. You know, it's like, should I go? Oh, let me back off. Oh, should I go? Okay, I'll go. And then he just sort of, in Christian Horner's words, decided to drive to Cologne.
It was like a very awkward roundabout situation for those guys. Do I go? No, you go. No, I'll go. No, wait, I'll go now this time. That's how the strategies unfolded up to the third stop. And this was the critical moment for what decided the top four as they were, because up until that point, Hamilton and Ricciardo had the same strategies. It was super soft, they started on, then to the soft, and then super softs again. Red Bull Racing had a three super soft strategy, essentially. They wanted to use them three times because they felt like they had the long run pace to make them work. Hamilton and Mercedes felt like they had enough inherent pace to make the softs work. Indeed, we should go back to Q1 at this point, because in Q1 they got through, they topped Q1 with the soft tyre while everyone else was on the super soft. So it was a founded argument.
Absolutely. It was, and by quite a margin too, you know.
Yeah.
Q1. And we looked at the timing screens, we looked at the sort of the tyre charts, and we were like, what? Are you kidding me?
We got so close to just leaving it. Some point going, well, there's no point being at this.
Oh, let's just
anymore.
Go on holiday now.
Yeah, well, we may as well. It seemed like everyone else had at this point. So Hamilton went on to a used set of soft tyres, whereas Daniel Ricciardo went on to a brand new set of super softs. And this is where the race momentarily became very, very interesting, because Ricciardo began closing the gap on Hamilton at quite a rate at some point, because it seemed like those tyres had enough pace in them.
That's right. I think he closed them down to about 5 seconds or something. But remember, that was also Hamilton managing his pace, because he's trying to eke out this engine for as long as he can. And he said as much. He said, look, I turned it down. I was just sort of managing my pace. And once it got to sort of the 5 second mark, I realized, okay, I need to get a move on. And he opened it up again. So I think there was a bit of that factoring into that as well. So
I think what's really interesting here, though, is that over time that equalized. The pace fell out of Ricciardo's tyres. Hamilton upped his pace slightly, just enough to keep that margin. So the order ultimately was first and second, Hamilton, Ricciardo. For third and fourth, though, the final place on the podium, Verstappen and Rosberg had also identical strategies. From the used super softs they started the race on to new super softs, then to new softs. Rosberg did the same as Hamilton and moved on to used softs, believing he presumably had enough pace. Verstappen went on to used super softs, on which he felt a little bit uneasy. He didn't look his very best in managing the tyres this weekend, did Verstappen. Part of the reason he couldn't beat Ricciardo. But whereas we saw Ricciardo ultimately couldn't catch Hamilton, Hamilton had enough inherent pace even on the used softs, Rosberg could not make a dent on Verstappen on... They were super softs, but they were used. Not even at the end of the race, when Verstappen's tyres should properly have been going off. What does this say about Rosberg, realistically?
I don't know. I mean, that final stint... Toto Wolff said after the race that Rosberg was struggling for pace because he didn't quite have the car in the sweet spot in terms of the setup. Whatever the reason, I don't know. But this season's really not turning out well for Rosberg. It started so well, around the four straight wins, seven in a row if you count back to the Mexican Grand Prix last year. But then he's just not been on it since then, because I was just doing the maths this morning, and Hamilton, since Monaco, which was his first win of the season, has scored 160 of the maximum 175 available, 160 points, the maximum 175 available. Rosberg in that time has scored just 98. He scored 100 out of 100 in the first four, and only 98 since Monaco, in the seven races since Monaco. And it's not like he's really been hamstrung by any reliability problems, except maybe he started a bit further back in Austria because of the gearbox, unscheduled gearbox change. But other than that, he's not really been hamstrung as such. He's just not strung those results together.
It's interesting, because we say that Rosberg's not really been on it. There is a question as to whether or not he's dropped the ball. It doesn't look like he's particularly bad, let's say. Like, he's not driving much worse than he was at the start of the season. Hamilton, on the other hand, ever since the Spanish Grand Prix, when he fell 43 points down, has raised his game. For me, it looks like Hamilton's raised his game, because the difference is he has outscored Rosberg by 62 points in that margin. As you said, 62 points since the middle of May, which is enormous. This is the Hamilton that we saw last year for me. And it's the same Rosberg we ultimately saw last year. Maybe 1% or 2% better. But is this just the expected order? Were we wrong to think that Rosberg could beat Hamilton in a straight fight?
I don't think it's the same Rosberg that we saw last year. I think Rosberg since Monaco has been a worse Rosberg than last year, in fact. Because it's not just that he hasn't... he's been outscored by Hamilton, but if you look at it, his results, he's only finished in those seven races, he's only finished thrice on the podium, which, considering he's in the fastest car on the grid, is remarkable. And again, without being hamstrung by any issues. I think, I don't know what's going on with him, but yeah, he has, compared to the start of the season, certainly dropped the ball.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how that's going to play out, because we are halfway through. Hamilton has unbelievably recovered that enormous deficit, to which we must pay credit, because this has not just been Hamilton rocking up, having a go, winning some races because he's kind of good. This is committed, brutal, ruthless Lewis Hamilton that has put his teammate to the sword.
Absolutely, and think about it, 43 points in the middle of May, 43 points behind in the middle of May, and now... you know, he's 19 points ahead, and if he wins in Belgium, even if Rosberg finishes second, he actually pulls one entire race win's worth of points clear of Rosberg. So, you know, he's got penalties coming up, possibly a drop to the very back of the grid. And if he sort of wins in Belgium and takes that penalty in Monza, even if he then doesn't finish, he'd still lead the championship by 1 point. Mm. I mean, think about it.
Yeah, and that's sort of the strategic way of looking at how he's going to take that penalty, because he knows he's going to need a new power unit. He's got Spa and Monza coming up, which are tracks that are reasonably easy to overtake. Certainly if you have a brand new power unit that's also the Mercedes power unit, yeah, that does tend to help. So another win would leave him in the clear, pretty much. I mean, there's a potential for him to have to take a second power unit penalty later in the year, but a 25-point margin is enough to give him proper control of his title.
Yeah, it's basically a proper reset. In Hungary, he said that, you know, okay, I'm just a point behind now. Well, he went into Hungary a point behind Rosberg. But he didn't see it as a reset because he'd got that engine penalty coming up. But effectively now, if he wins in Belgium and pulls, you know, 26 points clear of Rosberg, if even if Rosberg finishes second, that's a proper that's a reset and some.
Yeah. Now let's talk about Ferrari. Now, normally on this program, when we talk about strategic blunders, we talk about Williams. That's not been the case recently, to Williams's credit, so forgive me, please. But Ferrari had a very, very average race. I don't want to say terrible. I want to say extraordinarily average, because they finished where they qualified, the only difference being Vettel finished ahead of Raikkonen. Their strategy did nothing for them. Potentially there was an opportunity for them to move up and pressure the guys ahead of them, which we'll talk about in a moment. But was Ferrari ever in this race, really, considering that they just seemed sort of off the pace all weekend? Have they dropped back too much to play a part at all in the victory race?
I mean, if you ask them, they're still second best Mercedes. And they have been. Yeah. And they always will be.
It's an incredible aim for them. They had, of course, a three-stop strategy. Started on the used super softs, then went soft, used super softs, and softs again. The strategic blunder in question was not merely that they ran a very conservative race based on the soft tyre, which, while good at the opening parts of the race, wasn't effective enough at the end of the Grand Prix when most people were on super softs. The problem was that they thought they might be able to undercut Verstappen when he was behind Rosberg. Now, whether or not there's truth to this, they seem to believe that there was. The error was when they radioed Sebastian Vettel saying, "We need to pit now to undercut," Sebastian Vettel said, "Who?" And they said, "Oh, Verstappen." At which point Red Bull pitted Verstappen.
Absolutely. I think that was a very comical moment, because they said, "Okay, Sebastian, pit now. We can undercut. We can work the undercut." And Sebastian just says, "But they're miles away. Who are we going to undercut?"
Yeah.
And that was true, because I think except for the opening laps, I don't think Vettel was ever within undercut range of Verstappen. He probably would have just ended up finishing closer, but I don't think he was ever in range of the undercut, really.
It didn't seem like it, because the pace on the soft tyre just wasn't enough to beat. I mean, Verstappen, again, we saw, held off.
Well, I think on any tyre, really, for Ferrari this weekend, the pace wasn't good enough.
Also true. Interesting that they say, when we're looking at the second half of the season, "Well, we know what the problem is. We're not going to tell you what it is, but I reckon we'll fix it."
Yeah.
Does that ring true to you at all?
Well, they're so... they're so confident. I'm pretty sure they're going to win the Constructors' title this year, because they know what the problem is.
They're just so confident. Confidence alone will be enough for them. I want to look a little bit further down the order. Let's talk about Sergio Perez, because he's one man that made an undercut-esque move work, also with the soft tyre predominantly, because he had what he called his worst ever start in Formula 1, but he essentially beat everyone behind him, all the rabble, let's call them, Haas, Renault, etc., the Toro Rossos, by stopping on lap 8, getting off his used super soft tyres, and doing a longish run on the softs, then a shortish run on super softs, and then a very long run towards the end of the race on the softs. This is sort of just what Perez does, isn't it? He just manages.
This was a textbook Sergio Perez race, where, you know, he's always been known to be somebody who's great at managing the tyres, and so he's thrived in the sort of Pirelli era. That was textbook Perez race. And bear in mind that the Force India this year, I mean, typically their car has been good, easy on the tyres, really, not working the tyres too much, not taking too much out of them. So Perez has been able to do these longer stints. But this year, the Force India tyres, not that great on its tyres. And so I think Perez did a remarkable job to run those long stints that he did.
Yeah, and he really made that strategy work. The only alternative for him might have been a two-stop strategy, which was generally unfavoured up and down the field. Pirelli again said it would be marginal. The conditions on the day proved that it would it would be too difficult unless you'd really conditioned your tyres from qualifying if you're in the top 10 or otherwise. One man who did manage to do it and score points was Valtteri Bottas. He got very close to not scoring points, though, because he faded very quickly towards the end. He should have finished ahead of Button. He should have finished in 8th. In the end, he finished 9th because he stopped on lap 12 for softs and then lap 33 for softs again, which gave him a 33-lap stint on a single set of tyres. Williams spent so long on trying to work out how to maximise these tyres during this Grand Prix, during practice, especially on Saturday. They were frustrated they couldn't get it right. Is this just another sign that Williams isn't the team that can sort of recover on the weekend, on Saturdays and Sundays like they used to, and still end up third or second best?
I think the problem with Williams is they're just trying to do the best they can to get back up there in the mix. Because remember 2014, they ended the season as second best to Mercedes. Not in the constructors, but in terms of the pace ranking, certainly. And since then, I think they've fallen away a little bit behind Red Bulls and Ferraris and whatever. But I think they're just sort of trying different ways, focusing on different areas to see how they can get back up to the level of those teams and get back in the mix. Because the problem for Williams is they don't have the resources that these guys have. So they're inevitably being out-developed. So they're just looking around, casting around for anything that might give them a little bit more of an edge.
Now, I know if you ask anyone at Williams, they say money isn't the problem. Even though we know the financial inequality of Formula One does ultimately mean the more money you have, the more points you can score, really, because you can just throw more at the car. It's nice to think in Formula One that if you're cleverer than everyone else, you can beat them. And that's occasionally true. But is this a case? And Williams was cleverer than everyone else in 2014, or cleverer than most teams in 2014, not Mercedes. And they used to be able to get one up. They finished, was it, third in the championship for the last 2 years. Is this a sign now? I mean, Mercedes has been spending so much money over the last 3 years to maintain their position. Red Bull has no shortage of money. Even Ferrari, as hopeless as they are, have no shortage of money, and they're doing okay, better than Williams. Is this a sign now that we've gotten to that point in this cycle of regulations that cleverness isn't enough anymore?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that Williams are being left behind by Red Bull and Ferrari now, but no in the sense that look at Force India. I mean, you know, they don't have the resources that a Williams does for that matter, or any of the teams above them in the constructors, but they are threatening them for the top four. And that's just them being clever. Force India have always sort of, what these smaller teams generally have to do is they don't have the resources to conduct a lot of tests and a lot of experiments in the wind tunnel, etc., etc. So what they've really got to do is, you know, throw their weight behind a concept and hope it sticks. And that's, Force India have just basically been good at doing that. And that's what Williams, Pat Simmons actually said to me in Bahrain, that's what they would have to do as well.
And that's going to be the battle now, Williams and Force India. So as we look ahead to the next half of the season after this German Grand Prix, and I think in the sense of identifying the pecking order in the first half, I think it was quite an illustrative Grand Prix with Mercedes and Red Bull close-ish, Ferrari having dropped back, and more importantly for this sort of top end of the constructors' fight, Williams and Force India battling each other for fourth place. Now we know Williams has directed.
They may also be battling each other. Sorry to interrupt you, but they may also be battling each other for the services of Sergio Perez. You never
well, know. Battling for the love of Sergio Perez is a race that interests me greatly. We know Williams has turned his attention to its 2017 car quite early. Force India also has, but they had one eye on this championship. Did Williams change its mind too early? Have they done the right thing in moving to 2017, given they did not expect at the start of the year Force India to be this good? Because at the start of the year, Force India wasn't this good. They were heavily outscored by Williams, but all of a sudden, this has become a very close fight.
Well, I think they're right to shift their focus to 2017. But even if they finish fifth, and Force India finished fourth, that's okay, because I mean, look, Force India have already shifted everything to 2017. They're just now going to optimize the chassis. So I don't know how much more they can get out of it anyway. So Williams just needs to do that as well. And yes, there is a chance Force India might overhaul them, but as a very dear friend of mine says, if you don't win, second and downwards is like kissing your sister. So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, fair enough. Analogy is put to one side for now. Let's talk about McLaren as well in the second half of this year. They started still sort of a bit whatever, but since seasons progressed, Honda's brought a power unit upgrade, the chassis has been upgraded, Jenson Button, Fernando Alonso finally delivering, not in this race for Fernando Alonso, but for Jenson Button, yes, on that promise to be regular point scorers. Do you see that improving very much in the second half of the year?
I wouldn't say very much, but I certainly do sense this sort of forward, positive momentum building up behind McLaren. Yes, they're obviously way off where they want to be. Remember, this is a team that's hoping to topple Mercedes from the top of their standings.
It's like Ferrari.
Yeah, exactly. So, but there does seem to be a lot of optimism, a lot of energy and positive momentum building up behind this team. You know, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and it's getting bigger and it's getting brighter. So there seems to be that, certainly.
And to look ahead to the battle at the front for these last, it's 9 Grand Prix we have left in the second half of the season. Mercedes versus Red Bull Racing, very deliberately leaving out Ferrari. Prove me wrong, Ferrari, prove me wrong. Very close between Red Bull Racing and Mercedes. In fact, they split the Mercedes in this Grand Prix. Not quite enough to challenge Hamilton, but enough to push him a little bit. Red Bull Racing is a team that has plenty of resources. They know exactly what they're doing. We know they have a very successful, very recent history. Do you think that Red Bull Racing can score more wins at the second half of the year? And let's say wins that occur when Mercedes doesn't crash out of a Grand Prix.
I think it's possible. I think Singapore is the race they might look at to do that. But look, I mean, as far as the pecking order is concerned, I think it's going to, as the races tick by, increasingly be set in stone. Because remember, next year, Formula One is set for sweeping rule changes. Teams are all going to sort of gradually start shifting their focus more and more to developing next year's cars, and that means the scope for any upsets in the pecking order or any shuffling in the pecking order this year in the second half is just going to get smaller and smaller.
It will be an interesting second half of the year. It's been an interesting first half of the year as well, it must be said. We're on for, even if it's not a fight for the championship, in either championship, let's be honest, Abhishek, it seems like it could be a closely run second half of the year. Certainly, I hope it is. Certainly, Formula One needs it to be. Abhishek Takle, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of the Strategy Report. If you want to read more about the strategy of the German Grand Prix, go to f1strategyreport.com for Jack Leslie's write-up of all the action from Hockenheim, or search for F1 Strategy Report on Facebook or Twitter. Can you do a better job of strategy than Ferrari? It's not very hard. Prove yourself. Download the Formula Legend mobile game, now available on iOS and Android. My name's Michael Laminato. You can find me at Michael Laminato on Twitter. And be sure to join me at the very end of August when we look back on the resumption of Formula One from the Belgian Grand Prix.